Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to bridging the gap between adventure and adventurer by helping people select vehicles that fit one's lifestyle. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Could you be living next door to a spy? If you watched the recently concluded FX series, The Americans, the answer is yes. In that show, a couple from the Soviet Union has embedded themselves into American society. They have two American-born children, they run a travel agency, they speak perfect English, and have backstories that cover them as native-born Americans. But in fact, they are Russians, and they work daily to spy on Reagan-era America. It makes for great television and great fiction, but there is more truth to that story than you might imagine. In fact, much of that is Jack Barsky's story, a husband and father, college valedictorian, a computer programmer, and administrator at top American corporations. All the while, he was also acting as a KGB spy, ferreting out America's secrets during the last decade of the Cold War. When the Iron Curtain came down in the late 80s, Barsky managed to stay in the U.S. despite orders to return home. Eventually, though, the FBI caught wind of Barsky, but rather than jail him, he became an informant and eventually a U.S. citizen. Jack Barsky wrote about his life as a spy in the book Deep Undercover, My Secret Life and Tangled Allegiances as a KGB Spy in America. He's also appeared on cable news to weigh in on Russia's current activities. Contemporary worries about Russian interference in the 2016 election and the Kremlin-backed dissemination of fake news have caused fears about spies and spying to resurface. But Barsky says the spying that went on between the U.S. and the Soviet Union all through the Cold War never really stopped, and what we're seeing now is merely the natural continuation of what the Soviets were up to back then. And it's not just nations who have to keep their guard up, corporations do too. That's the message Jack Barsky is spreading using his own story as an example. He says HR departments have to be the first line of defense in protecting their organizations by vetting prospective employees. Jack Barsky was in town June of last year to discuss that, and given the ongoing investigations into Russian activities in our democracy, we're going to listen back to that conversation this hour. Welcome to Charlotte. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
I just mentioned this TV show, The Americans, on FX. You've been an extra on that show, I understand.
Yes, episode 510, where I'm just standing at an exit of a dry cleaner's, and I put on my most accomplished spy look. When this is an actress is coming out of there, she's carrying some clothes, and I look after her like that. Uh-huh. And then after 15 seconds, I just walk after her, follow her, and unfortunately, that's all the action I got.
I actually saw that episode.
You
before,
did?
Like 2 days ago, because I'm way backed up. But I remember that scene, but I didn't remember you. So you blended into the background.
I wasn't memorable. Well, it's probably because of the green pants they put on me. I was. They're very authentic in that show, and there's nothing that doesn't fit.
Right.
The cars that they parked in the streets, mm-hmm. the clothes that they put on everybody. And if you had your cell phone sticking out, you know, the producer came and said, put that away.
Right.
So I had these ugly clothes on. He says, this is what we were wearing in the 80s.
It's amazing, isn't it?
I guess we did.
But I was going to compliment you on just blending into the background, which is what a good spy should do.
Yes, sir.
The premise of that show sounds very much like your life. Is it based on you in any way?
It's not. But when my interview with 60 Minutes came out, the producers went nuts. They were ecstatic because here was proof of what they concocted actually happened in reality. So they reached out to me. So, you know, I went to visit them a couple of times.
Right.
And then we did this extra thing because it was just like, it was just delicious to do for
sure.
Both of us, right?
You were an East German citizen recruited by the KGB to spy in America, and you were embedded here during the Cold War, the last decade of the Cold War, and we'll get all the particulars of that in a moment. But when you were spying for the KGB, how many others were there like you, embedded in America, raising families, holding jobs, working their way up corporate ladders to try to reach influencers in American policy?
I don't have direct knowledge because this kind of information was kept away from me. You know, I was kept in complete isolation. However, there is some pretty conclusive proof that there were at the most maybe five of us. the fellow who was responsible for the FBI eventually catching up with me, his name is Vasily Mitrokhin, who was an archivist at the KGB, who hand-copied lots and lots of stuff over many years and then smuggled it out and handed it over to MI5, the British Intelligence mm-hmm. Service. And amongst those handwritten notes, there was my name, as well as some indication that this was a planned wave of illegals, sort of the third wave, according to what he actually wrote in a book. And there were about five of us trained. This is not a surprise. I had 5 years of training.
So is this same kind of program still going on today? I know you have no direct knowledge probably, but would you assume that given that Vladimir Putin used to lead the KGB, that the same kind of program is going on today?
You don't have to assume. There's proof. I mean, in 2010, I don't know if you remember that, there were five couples mm-hmm. that were caught by the FBI and eventually exchanged, and they were illegals. Now, not in the same way I was, in that they were brought in sort of the traditional way. You know, I was brought in, and I pretended to have been born here. Mm-hmm. They came in through other countries, and they had foreign accents, but they had a backstory that didn't go back to the Soviet Union. And they were embedded in an American society. I think they all were citizens at the time, and they were employees of the KGB,
yeah.
the FSB, the successor of the KGB. This has been going on, and I wouldn't be surprised if there aren't some folks like that in this country today.
Do we do it too?
Do we do it? I think the CIA would like to, but it would be very hard to convince somebody to give up a good life in the United States to go to Russia and, blend in
right.
with discomfort.
How do we know you're not still a spy?
You don't. You absolutely don't, except, you don't, but I did pass a couple of lie detector tests with the FBI.
Well, why aren't you in jail or dead?
In
other words, why didn't the Americans put you in jail when they discovered you, and why didn't the KGB just end you when they discovered that you weren't going to come home?
Two questions. Okay. All right. Two questions, two answers. I'm not in jail because the American government, the FBI, and the entire American government figured I'd be more valuable out of jail and cooperating.
Okay.
That's the answer that the FBI will give you, and I've heard that answer. So I'm, this is not a direct answer for me. I had nothing to do with it. That wasn't my decision.
Okay.
I was glad it was made. The answer to the question why I'm not dead is one word: God. I have no explanation. I should not be here talking to you.
Hmm. I'm surprised you're not in some kind of a witness protection program.
That was something the FBI considered, and I'm very grateful that they decided to do something which was really unusual, to leave me in society the way I was, because I had so many connections. And, I was deeply embedded in society, and so were my family.
Mm-hmm.
To take us out of there and put us someplace in Arizona and have us start all over again would have been, A, very costly to the American taxpayer, and B, would have been very disruptive and possibly would have destroyed our family at that point.
Mm. So let's go back to the 1970s. You're a young man. You're on your way to becoming a chemistry professor, which I understand was your dream job in East Germany. Somebody, somewhere, somehow looked at you and thought, this guy might be a good spy. And then eventually the KGB came out to you, sent you to Moscow for training. What was it about you that made them think you would be good at this or a good candidate to be a spy?
Well, you don't start recruiting, and they didn't start recruiting me to with the idea that, based on what they knew about me, that I would be a good spy. But I was a standout in East German society. I received a National Honor Scholarship that was given to about 50, 60 people every year. I had nothing but A's in college, and this was one heck of a hard program. And I was active in the party and in the Communist Youth Movement, so I was a perfect candidate for security services to look at.
So this guy comes to your dorm room and interviews you or has a conversation with you. How did he identify himself?
Well, he started out with a stupid lie because it was so stupid. This guy was incompetent, fundamentally incompetent, and he was I don't know if he was KGB or Stasi, East German Intelligence, but, in hindsight, I think he was probably one of the, unofficial KGB representatives mm-hmm. in East Germany. He was German. And he introduced himself as some member of a local optics company, very famous, called Zeiss, still known. It's a brand. And that was in the town where I studied, that had about 20,000 employees, and he said he wanted to talk with me about my career plans after I graduate from college. And the reason I'm saying that it was really stupid, and there's no better word, in those days, companies didn't recruit. When you graduated from college, you were placed by the college, the party, the whatever, but by the central organization that would tell you, you go here, you go there. If you were near the top of the class, you had some choices, mm-hmm. but no company ever directly approached anybody. So immediately when he said that, I was thinking, I didn't think KGB, but I thought Stasi.
So at what point did you discover that you were being recruited for spy work?
Rephrase the question, please.
At what point did you realize they're coming after me to be a spy?
Sure. Now, in that very same conversation, he after like 15 minutes after the ice was broken, he changed his tune and then he said, actually, I'm not from Carl Zeiss. I'm from the government. And I didn't, at this point, I was giving him a lot of leeway. I was playing his game fundamentally. I thought I was a superior intellect. I always thought that in those days anyway. But the point is that, I was playing his game and because I could have asked him, what part of the government. I didn't. So when he said, I'm from the government, I said, okay.
You kind of knew.
I know where you're from.
So I don't want to point something that's so obvious out to you, but I'm going to point it out for our listeners. Being a chemistry professor doesn't strike me as being dangerous unless something blows up in the lab.
Something did blow up occasionally.
But being a spy is naturally dangerous. Did it occur to you that when you agreed to take this on, or maybe you didn't have a choice, that this could be a life-altering, life-ending, life-changing, certainly, experience for you?
Yes, but I put this out of my mind. This was way too attractive with regard to the adventure that it offered. And, I don't know why that is, but I've always been extremely optimistic, and I have always, if there's any problem in my life, I know it's going to go away.
Huh.
And when you start thinking about situations that have some risk attached to them, you just don't want to execute on this stuff, right? Mm. So I didn't think about it. I put this out of my mind. Yeah, sure. I might go to jail. Big deal. They're going to get me out. There's in my line of work as an undercover agent, there wasn't any physical danger. I didn't get weapons training or anything like that. So it's not like the Americans.
Okay.
It was just more the intellectual kind of spying. So that danger wasn't there. But clearly, I was aware that I could go to jail.
Did you know you'd be assigned to the United States? When
That did not happen until it was discovered that I had some ability to learn English.
We'll talk about the training and learning English and the fact that you speak perfect English in just a moment when we come back at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that believe a car is used for more than just getting from place to place. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on Listener Funded, 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Our guest today is Jack Barsky, a former KGB agent embedded in the United States in the last decade of the Cold War by the KGB. He's a former East German. and the author of Deep Undercover, My Secret Life and Tangled Allegiances as a KGB Spy in America. He was embedded here as what was known then as illegals, people who come here without fake documentation, essentially, and become people other than who they are with false identities. Your real name is Albert Dietrich. Is that correct? We're close?
Yes, and don't make me say it.
Okay, all right. And they gave you the name Jack Barsky, which they got from a tombstone
right.
of a 10-year-old boy who died in 1955, and they gave you a birth certificate. Was it his birth certificate?
Yes, it was. It was an official birth certificate in his name. It was acquired by a diplomat out of Washington, D.C., a Soviet diplomat who was KGB.
Could that be done today, given computer databases and things like that? Or was that only possible because that didn't exist?
What I did, you can't do anymore. If you're born in the U.S., you get automatically, you get a Social Security number.
Right. Yes, you didn't have a Social Security number. And when you came here, that became an obstacle that somehow you overcame.
Yeah, there was this window, this opening that we walked through, and that there were a couple of groups that were exempt from the Social Security law. That was farm workers and employees of churches and religious organizations.
How did you know that?
The Russians told me.
Okay,
you can go and claim that you never had a Social Security card because you worked on a farm.
Which is what you did, and they gave you one.
And they did.
Why couldn't you just make up a number?
Well, we want it to be as genuine as possible. Of course you can. You can come in here with all kinds of fake documents, but those wouldn't hold up to scrutiny.
You came in on a Canadian passport.
Yes.
So they gave you, were you Jack Barsky on that passport?
No, this was my travel document. I was William Dyson.
So you came in on a Canadian passport, and then as soon as you got here, you got rid of the Canadian passport.
Yes.
How did you get an American passport?
Well, I didn't. And that was one of the biggest failures of my career. And sort of I'm very glad it failed that way. See, the plan was for me to acquire all this genuine documentation and then get a passport.
Yeah.
Once I have an American passport, the plan was to send me back to Europe, let's say for argument's sake, Switzerland,
mm-hmm.
where the Russians would have set me up with a business,
mm-hmm.
pumped a lot of money into that business.
Made you wealthy.
Made me wealthy, bring me back here, at which point I wouldn't have to explain to Americans how I acquired my wealth. I had a business in Europe, and at that point, the way American society works, you have access to people that are of interest.
Because you're wealthy, you have access to people of interest.
Of course, you can go, you can join a country club, you get to mingle with the decision makers.
Right.
That was the plan. It failed because we just made a mistake with regard to the application process. And
why bring you into America as a young person and make you essentially work your way up when they could have just started a business, made you the head of it, quote unquote, the head of it, and then brought you in as a successful entrepreneur who was, 29, 32 years old, and start up the ladder already? Why didn't they just do it that way?
Well, let me try this again. It's it's because they wanted me to be as clean as possible to a point where I could have become a Manchurian candidate.
Okay.
Right? Anything fake in that picture was no good.
Okay.
So, as you know, everything had to look genuine to the extent possible.
So if they failed with you, and you just told me that essentially it didn't work, have they failed with everyone?
It's likely that there was not a single individual like me that was successful,
okay.
really successful. It's extremely difficult to pull this off.
You had a particular facility for English, and you spent time being trained, I guess, both in spycraft, but also in American customs and American manners, etc., and learning English fluently, flawlessly. I mean, people have a really difficult time, except in certain situations, which you can easily explain away by saying that your mother was German.
Right.
And therefore you have maybe a slight German tinge to your accent, but I don't hear it, quite honestly. What did, in your training, What, aside from spycraft, how to send messages and things like that, what did they tell you about America that proved to be not correct?
Fundamentally, they didn't tell me a whole lot, and what they thought they knew about the United States was not very accurate.
Why? I mean, they have diplomats here. They observe.
Right. And this is I have a copyright on the following statement. It's not in the book, but think about an aquarium situation. You go and you look at the fish from the outside and you think you know what it's like to be a fish. Mm-hmm. And then you want to teach somebody how to be a fish. I was going to be a fish. The American diplomats they looked at American society from the outside. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you know this, but let's say they work for the United Nations or the Soviet embassy in D.C. They lived in a compound where all the other diplomats lived. They went to work with all their colleagues. So they did go shopping and they went to the movies and the theater and they had some contact with Americans, but they were never really embedded. They didn't know what it was like to live as an American.
I see.
And so they had the illusion that they did, and fundamentally they didn't know what they didn't know. This is one of the most bizarre examples. Was one of my handlers once cautioned me. He said, "You got to stay away from the Jews," and they sent me to New York.
Your ultimate goal, as you write, I believe, was not only to get close to influential people, but you were supposed to get close to national security advisors, Zbigniew Brzezinski, in order to spy on him. But you came to New York with not a lot of money,
yeah,
no social security card. You had to support yourself. You had to get an apartment to live in. They gave you, I think, $10,000. That's not going to last you long in New York City. And you ended up being a bicycle messenger. How
right.
are you going to reach influential people as a bicycle messenger?
No, you don't. But, you know, they really appreciated my my initiative and my finding my way. When they sent me, when they said, you know, you need to find a job somehow, they had some ideas that wouldn't work either. One of them was to go and get a job as a dock worker. Hmm. In Manhattan, well, this is highly unionized. You can't get in
right.
unless you know somebody.
Right.
So that didn't work. So I had to kind of like improvise and come up with something that you can do for which you don't need documented qualifications.
That seems to me to be the surest way to the bottom. I mean, you're going to get menial jobs
yeah.
to do that. You're a smart guy. You were going to be a chemistry professor, and here you are, a bicycle messenger
uh-huh.
in New York, scraping by.
Yeah.
Did you ever have second thoughts at that stage? Like, what have I done? Because you left behind, I believe,
a wife
and child, right?
Yes.
Did you not go, what am I doing?
Occasionally, but I did it all for a good cause, and I knew, you know, I was absolutely 100% convinced stalwart communist.
Right.
So you sacrifice.
Ultimately, you got a job at Metropolitan Life Insurance because you also have a facility as a coder, as a computer programmer. Mm. And in that job, you had access to personal records.
I did.
Of a lot of American citizens. Their medical records, all kinds of records. Did you ever access that, use it, give it to the KGB, et cetera?
Yeah, that in hindsight, this is really bizarre. They knew that I had access to the records of about 15 million people, and I could have easily extracted all of that, and they didn't bite. They had absolutely no interest in that information. They weren't aware of the value of data at the time.
Mm-hmm.
That has changed.
Really?
Yep.
But that you did give them software.
Yeah.
And it was commercially available software, right?
They
could have bought it.
Yes, but it was, you know, in those days there were a lot of restrictions as to what you can sell to the Soviet Union.
Mm-hmm.
And this software was, I guarantee you, was something that the originator, the company I won't mention, was not allowed to sell to the Eastern Bloc.
So what kinds of information did they want you to pass along to them, and what kind of information were you able to pass along?
This was one of those free-for-all, whatever you get, you know, get to know interesting people, profile people, you know, if you could get, connections at Columbia University, the Institute of Foreign Relations, you know, where Brzezinski taught, the Hudson Institute, the Trilateral Commission, all the, so these were all like wishful thinkings. They threw them out. Try to get, you know, make contact with the, it was, I didn't have a task list with, to check off and say, do this, 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 and
so
this.
So this is kind of like soft spying. You were probably one arm of their efforts.
They had, oh, yeah, absolutely.
They had hardcore spies doing other work.
Absolutely.
Elsewhere.
You know, the value of me was fundamentally that I was there.
Yeah. How did you report back?
Fundamentally, in secret writing, primarily through the snail mail, letters in with secret writing.
That means secret writing.
Secret writing is, you know, you write a letter and with an open text, and then there's a method by which, you know, you use something like a contact paper with which you make traces on that open on that paper that are not visible, some kind of a chemical that is then developed and becomes visible.
And did you have a personal contact that you met with here in
no.
the States? Never.
Never, never.
But there were drop points where you delivered things, dead drop zones.
Dead drops. The only communication, so to speak, and that's indirect, that I had while in New York was dead drops and signals. This was all asynchronous, yeah. Right?
This is during the Soviet Union, during the communist times, when times were hard in East Germany, we are told, in the West, and times were hard in Moscow and throughout the rest of the Soviet Union. You come to America, you come from a little kind of a, what did you call it, the Valley of the Know-Nothings?
The Valley of the Clueless.
Of the Clueless.
The reason that we had this nickname is because you couldn't get West. We were situated in such a way that you couldn't get West German TV. It was the only area in East Germany, unless you had this phenomenal huge antenna on your house. And then, of course, the Stasi knew what this was for, and they would knock on your door and be not very nice to you.
Yeah. So you didn't know much more than what they told you, and you were fully indoctrinated into the
100%
beliefs of the Communist Party and et cetera. And you find yourself in the United States, and not everything is rosy here, we know that, but you go to a grocery store, we were told back then, and the difference between what you could get on the grocery store in Moscow and what you could get in just a small-town grocery store was phenomenal.
Yeah.
You see how Americans live.
Uh-huh.
At what point does it dawn on you that perhaps a lot of what you think you know is not true?
Those dots I did not connect. And there was a rationale that we used to explain why the U.S. and Western Europe had a higher standard of living is because of the exploitation of the rest of the world, particularly Africa, South America, Asia. So, and we, us communists, were going to right that wrong and then bring everybody up to a reasonable standard of living. That wasn't that hard to
and bring those at the top down to a reasonable
you
standard.
Bet.
Yeah. So at what point did it dawn on you that that may not be true or that was just the wrong way to look at things?
Well, what initially dawned on me was that the whole idea of that all of capitalism is evil was actually fundamentally wrong, because when I worked for MetLife, it was really good. And it felt almost like in the old days in East Germany, where the government took care of you, sort of, in my case, they did. And here I was in this paternalistic type company, mutual insurance company, and they took care of you. They gave you free lunch. They gave you good work. The colleagues were nice. The bosses were nice. So it felt really good. And so the whole idea of all of capitalism is evil, sort of, I had to discard that.
Mm-hmm.
And I started slowly moving away from the extreme communism, which, by the way, also happened to others, to KGB colleagues who volunteered to me that, you know, they would be more comfortable with a left-wing type socialism, something that we are—
Other than communism.
Yes, socialism, sort of like a convergence between capitalism and communism.
Mm-hmm. You also, as because you work for Metropolitan Life, I'm sure you were earning a decent amount of money. You built a life here. You, mm-hmm. you have a home. You ultimately got married for a while. You were living as a bigamist. You had two families that didn't know about
Thanks
each other.
Thanks for pointing that out.
Well, I'm just, you know, you pointed out in your book. I'm just bringing it to light. But you had these two families. Was there a plan? Did they tell you at some point, we will extract you from the United States and bring you back home? Was that going to be the plan? And if that was going to be the plan, what did you plan to do with these two families?
Well, this is what this is like the can you kick down the proverbial can you kick uh-huh. down the road. This was a decision I didn't have to make. The extraction, the bringing me back was sort of open-ended. There was always this idea, like maybe 10 years, but it wasn't quite clear. By the time they thought that my cover was about to be blown and they called me back as an emergency mm-hmm. withdrawal, the 10 years were already up. So, but at that point, that road, there was a dead end at the end, so that you couldn't kick that can anymore. And then I had to make that decision.
We're focused on Russia today because of Vladimir Putin and also because of the influence that he may or he tried to exert on the 2016 presidential election, the hacking of emails at the Democratic National Committee and elsewhere, and also possible, unproved as yet, collusion between members of the Trump campaign and Russia. This sounds a lot more sophisticated than what you were asked to do in the 1970s. Is it?
Maybe it isn't. Maybe it isn't. Nowadays, first of all, we call it fake news now. In the old days, it was called disinformation.
Okay.
The KGB has had a long track record of planting disinformation in the West. I give you one wonderful example, and that's for quite some time, and maybe even today, there are some people who believe that J. Edgar Hoover, the old head
FBI
of
director.
FBI, was a secret cross-dresser
uh-huh.
and wandered around in his apartment in his privacy with a dress on. That was planted by the KGB in a French newspaper that eventually seeped into American public knowledge. So this has always happened.
Let me stop because we have to go to a break. We'll come back
more
and talk about disinformation and more in a moment with Jack Barsky at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. This hour, we're listening back to our June 2017 conversation with the man CBS 60 Minutes called The Spy Among Us, Jack Barsky, a KGB spy who created a comfortable life for himself here in the U.S. in the 70s and 80s while also spying on America for the Soviet Union. During his spying days, he climbed his way up the corporate ladder, feeding information back to the Kremlin. Since then, he's found religion, and he became a U.S. citizen after the FBI discovered him in the 90s. I want to go back to something you just talked about, J. Edgar Hoover and this allegation that's been out there since I can remember that he was a crossdresser in his private life. He's the former FBI director, and you just told me that was a story planted in a French newspaper by the KGB. How do you know that?
The source is, again, Vasily Mitrokhin. He wrote two books, one's called The Sword and the Shield, which is an overall history of the KGB based on the notes that he took.
And he's
him.
The guy that turned you in?
Yes.
Okay.
And the other one is, I forgot, but there's two books. Anyway, that is as good a source as you will ever get.
So given what we think, what the all of our intelligence agencies says did in fact go on with Russian interference or attempts to interfere in our elections and a possible collusion with one campaign or another, that sounds more sophisticated than what you went through. Do the Russians today better understand America than their Soviet counterparts did in the Cold War?
Yes.
Why?
I believe they do because there have been more Russians that have studied in the West, that have done business with the West. In the old Soviet days, it was only a few hundred people who were allowed to operate in Western
countries. But Russia today is not the Soviet Union. No. The Soviet Union and the United States at the height of the Cold War were these two superpowers who controlled more nuclear weapons than the world could ever possibly need. And then the common deterrent was the fact that if we do it, they'll do it, so we won't do it. Russia, it seems to me, is struggling to survive, to keep itself together, and to become, to regain some kind of prominence on the world stage. Is that what's motivating all of this, or is it simply the power-hungry nature of Vladimir Putin?
Well, you gave both answers that I would give you. It's a great marriage. I am convinced, based on what I know about the Russian character and Russian history, that it didn't take a Vladimir Putin for Russia to want to regain, significance and reestablish sort of an empire, which they had for a while as when they were the Soviet Union. And now enter Vladimir Putin, who's got an ego that's, I believe, is at least as big as our president's ego, who is trying to build a monument to himself. Mm. So there's a great marriage between the two of them, and this is somewhat, obviously, it's dangerous.
One of the things you're going to talk about today is cybersecurity. You are a programmer, a coder. You've worked at several large corporations, including a company in New York that controls part of our electric grid. Was that after you were discovered to be a spy?
Oh, well after, sure.
Were you there when you were a spy?
No, not at all.
Could you have gotten there when you were a spy?
I believe so.
Could there be people there today who are spies?
It's possible. I wouldn't say it's likely, but it's possible. Because here's the thing. When we're talking about an insider threat, it's somebody who means you harm to get to the inside of a company. They obviously wouldn't attempt to do that unless they had a clean record. So whatever background check you do, the typical background check you check with the FBI and local authorities, is there a police record? That doesn't give you anything. The would-be insider doesn't have a record. Mm. So there's the vetting that needs to happen there, particularly in these sensitive type of organizations, needs to be a lot more deeper.
Well, you ultimately went to college here. You got your GED when you arrived, shortly after you arrived. Then you ultimately went to college here, and you were, the valedictorian of the college? And the KGB did not want you to speak, but you had to speak because they insisted that you speak because you were the valedictorian.
Yeah,
high profile is not good.
No, that was a really lousy mistake that I made. It had to do with ambition and not understanding what it means to have a perfect average. Yeah. When the college approached me and says, you're going to have to speak. And I said, what? And I said, I didn't know that.
But there's no picture in the yearbook, correct?
No, there's none.
Why not? I mean, it seems to me that you'd want that so that job prospects could check you out. And,
I didn't want, and that's why I was a reluctant speaker. They sort of forced my hand. There's one little picture that a friend of mine took with a Polaroid, which was done from way, way back. Uh-huh. But that's all the record I have of that appearance.
So it would have been difficult for employers to check much beyond what you've told them about yourself. I mean, where did you go to high school? Who were your friends in high school? What did you do extracurricularly in high school? You had no resume.
My backstory was such that it would have been difficult to find proof that it was not correct. But, I, for instance, what high school did you attend? Well, I attended Peter Stuyvesant in Manhattan. I didn't graduate from that high school because I didn't have a high school diploma. But if you went to check with that school, you would have found that there's no record of a Jack Barsky.
Right.
So there were some things that if you really want to check back into my history in my past, you would have found some problems.
And that is why you say that HR departments are the line of first defense in protecting organizations.
Yeah, if not HR, who? I mean, this is what they do.
But it's so difficult today, particularly if you're checking on references from previous jobs, to get that information because people are afraid of being sued.
Yes, and this is a problem because there's so many laws now to protect your privacy. When you go to a hospital, you have to sign, before you go to a doctor, you have to sign 10 documents to allow them to share some information, even with your wife.
Right.
And these are hurdles that our government has put in place that sort of in some ways hurt ourselves.
Let me go back to this computer programming thing and Coder and the fact that you worked at a company, Metropolitan Life, that had a lot of access. You had a lot of access to data about American citizens. And then later on, you went to a company that runs part of the electric grid, which is, we are told, pretty vulnerable to exterior attack. You experts say we need to do a better job of hardening our computer systems, be they election computer systems or the kinds that control our waterworks. And you say that people in America have a lax attitude towards data security.
Oh, you bet. I mean, look at when you're talking about the sophistication of the hack of the DNC, it didn't require any sophistication. Mr. Podesta's password was
password.
Thank you very much. And he is one of the leaders in this country. So if he doesn't understand the fundamentals of hygiene in the cyber world, that means you can't blame everybody else.
Has this taught us the lesson? Will we be more careful going forward? What has to be done to wake us up?
As a matter of fact, when I got first on CNN, when the Russian hacking was a big story, I tried to actually divert the discussion into, you know, doing the right thing with regard to cybersecurity. It didn't take. No, it's not. At this point, it's still not a matter of a public discussion in this country, and it should be. That's one of the things that I'm stressing a lot when I'm out there speaking. And I, at this point, I don't know who can lead this. I think the government should do something about it, as well as the major information technology companies.
Would you assume? I know you probably don't have any contact with the Russians, but would you assume, from what your experience has been, that they take it more seriously? Could we hack them as easily as they hacked us?
Oh yes,
and we do probably.
And we do. We just don't we don't brag about it, but. We absolutely do. It would be foolish not to. These are weapons, and it's a war. Yeah. So we can't just sit by and do nothing.
So-called fake news, which you've already mentioned, comes from a lot of different areas. Some of it is homegrown. Some of it is from Russia and other places. Some of it is sincerely believed by the people who disseminate it. Some people are cynical, and they're just putting stuff out there to throw people off. This fake news situation, this is happening on social media, and it's been proven that the Russians did plant false information in our media, in social media. How do you combat that?
You don't. You don't. You know, so this is where we as a country are vulnerable. We are a free society. You know, we have the First Amendment. You can put anything out there. Be that a lie or the truth. So what you need to have an educated public, and you need to have a media that filters this stuff a little more instead of speculating.
But they don't believe the media. They've been told through fake news sources not to believe the mainstream media, and it's stuck.
So what we now have is the place in Alice in Wonderland, is it, where you don't know what's true anymore, the Hall of Mirrors.
Right.
It's scary. I don't know what to do about it.
And some of this is being perpetrated because of the rabid partisanship in this country.
Exactly.
And I don't
know
which came first, the chicken or the egg here, whether we became rabidly partisan because of the lies we're being told by one side about the other, or whether we're just rabidly partisan and that makes lies come out, or we distort the truth for our own political purposes. But you say that partisan politics, with all the allegations and speculation about Trump's campaign ties to Russia, benefit one person the most, Vladimir Putin.
Vladimir Putin.
How so?
There's no doubt about it, because never mind, I don't think he has the illusion that he could actively tip an election this way or another, or one way or another. You try, but the most important thing that they want to do is just like destabilize democracies, make them like look at themselves, fight with themselves, take the focus away from who is the real adversary, which is Russia.
Wouldn't it be easier for them to become a player? As opposed to a player among us, as opposed to a player against us.
But their values, if you call them that, are diametrically opposed to us. We can't play.
What are their values?
Their values are, you know, it's all about me. There's no freedom. There's, you know, it's, I grab as much power as I can and I rule the rest of the world. That's not the way we, you know, there are mechanisms in place in a democracy in this country that prevent this from ultimately from happening. Mm-hmm. That doesn't mean that people don't try. But we have a constitution that sort of was set up in understanding the frailty and the of human nature, really, so that dictators can't easily appear on the scene in a place like this.
When you look back on where you came from in terms of your philosophy, because you were dyed-in-the-wool communist in East Germany and at a young age, and to what you just said,
mm-hmm.
What do you think? How did that transition happen? How have you done a 360 or 180?
That was a slow process, and it started, you know, when I resigned from the KGB, I withdrew sort of emotionally from the world scene, mm-hmm. You know, for what it's worth. But I didn't want to play on that stage anymore. But then when the wall came down and the internet made information accessible, I first found out how bad things were in the country where I grew up, stuff I didn't know. What, you know, Stasi did, you know, you're familiar with the movie The Lives of Others? A lot of people watch this. This is very, very much realistic. And it just blew my mind. I said, well, this is bad. And then slowly I started reading about the history of Russia, the Soviet Union, the KGB. And, you know, then Mitrokhin came out, and I realized that I had believed in a massive construct of lies that, you know, I had to throw it all away and replace it with what? Well, I'm going back to the principles upon which this country was founded. And this is what I believe in now, today.
And they were able to do that to you and to millions of other
yes.
people through information control.
Absolutely.
And the
yes.
lack of a free press.
That's correct.
So when you hear attacks on American media today as being the enemies of the people, what do you think?
Well, in isolation, that statement is should not be left to stand. On the other hand, what we have today in the media is, whether that be left or right, media are not reporting news anymore. They are agenda-driven. So therefore now—
All of them?
I don't think so. I don't think so, but a lot. You know, I've been on CNN, MSNBC, and Fox, and it so happened that with every one of them, the anchor person tried me to agree with certain positions that they took,
mm-hmm.
and I managed to, you know, politely disagree.
Well, it's fine, but if they tried to get you to agree, maybe you did agree that they were just trying to pull that information out of you.
Right. It's just... you know, as media, you also have a social responsibility, and not, you know, what I don't like is the speculation that's heaped on top of speculation,
yeah.
and there's no data underneath.
Well, that's ratings-driven, which translates to the bottom line, which
yep.
goes to capitalism.
Yes.
So are you going to rethink capitalism now?
Yes, and this you caught me in this is a catch-22 situation. Absolutely right. And I honestly, I don't have an answer. Maybe I'll come back to you when I find one.
All right. Jack Barsky, former KGB agent. He's the author of a book about his life as an agent, Deep Undercover, My Secret Life and Tangled Allegiances as a KGB Spy in America. You might have seen him on 60 Minutes with Steve Croft. Thank you for the hour.
You're welcome.
Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to helping customers select vehicles that fit one's lifestyle. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.